Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Blah, 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 blah,
good
blah, blah.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning to you, lurking conservatives out there in the ether, waiting to get angry or waiting to hear something that might change their ways. How are you guys? How are you, Mark Riley?
I'm doing okay. I'm not one of those conservatives who's waiting, though.
No, good. I would hope not, because then you'd be surprising all of us.
No, then I'd be Armstrong Williams.
Yeah, that's right. And you'd have a whole different show, wouldn't you? What the hell's going on today? The president, or the leader of the neocon death cult, is, you know, talking. We're going to get into what he said about Social Security. I find that literally, Riley, sadly, what I worry about in terms of aging is rarely money so much as becoming pear-shaped, like my father.
Oh,
for some reason, in my family, I swear to God, I don't know when it happens, but for some reason, I just see this slow pear shaping, and like, I, you know, I'm
but
I'm,
you work out. You don't have to get pear shaped to work out.
What if it's genetic, man? What if one day I'm just like, what the hell happened to my bottom half? Why is it that size?
Do you know how many people have made billions of dollars in convincing the American public that there's no such thing as heredity when it comes to what kind of shape you're in?
Look, when I see it, when I go to a family reunion,
you ever see Billy Blanks? Mr. Tybo.
But if you go to any gathering of your family and you see maybe a recurring genetic theme, say pear-shapedness, you might want to think, like, is there any way I can avoid this? But meanwhile, I should be worrying about, am I going to have a pot to pee in when I am in?
Well, yeah, you should be. You should worry about that. But, I mean, look, you know, when it comes to my family gatherings, I was humiliated at when I was a kid, so I'm not worried about it as an old man.
Oh, boy.
I could weigh 300 pounds. It wouldn't bother me one bit with
my
family.
I'm too vain. But, I got to go out. Everyone played softball last night, but because we have to go to bed on the children's schedule, we weren't able to do that. Rachel Maddow was there. Passman was there. Kayla was there. Kayla, how did it go?
John Singh take me out to the ball game.
McDonald was there.
It was a good game, man.
It was a good game?
Yes. The final score was a little...
Here comes Maddow. It was a good game? What are you judging that on?
Maddow had an A-Rod type night, but it was not a good game.
We had to stop keeping score at one point. We lost by more than 10, is all I know.
The final score was a little, you know.
We had to round the score. That's how bad it was.
Is that something parents make you do so no one gets their feelings hurt?
Cashman made us do it so we didn't get our feelings hurt.
What are you guys playing?
We were playing as DC Comics, and our team, is, as you may or may not know, is the Air America Radio Jim Earls. This was the inaugural game in the history of the Air America Radio softball team.
Mm-hmm.
And I, as the coach and founder of the team, I was very pleased with the effort that was put forth.
Now, Dan Passman, you lost against comic book?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. You know, you start to sound like Bush.
We were no match for their superpowers.
Clutch Larson is in the booth secretly thrilled with DC Comics.
I told you it wouldn't work.
When will they take on the Marvel Universe?
One of the guys from DC Comics said he sent over a whole bunch of comics to the network care of Larson. I don't think anybody else ever got their hands on those.
That was like... He must have mistook it for his own bag of comics.
Bag of comics?
Of course. Those guys always have this mailing where they, once a month, they get this box of 50 comics and they haul
like
up for
the Franklin Mint.
Yeah. So did you make any great plays? Who made the great plays?
Dan made a great play.
Yeah?
I did make a pretty sweet catch. McDonald made a play. Brennan made a play that would have been on SportsCenter if there had been any media coverage of our game. he was rolling on the ground with the ball, and while rolling, made a blind throw to second base. It was caught by comedy writer Bruce Cherry to make the out at second base.
Brendan did that?
Yeah.
Brendan was very, very good. You know, Kalo also had a falling down throw. He dropped the ball, but then he fell down on top of it and then threw it very beautifully from his lying down position. It was very handsome.
Yeah. So that was one of those moments you're like, ooh, silly, but good. it turned it around.
What's next? You're going to have to put Barca loungers in the infield or something for all these guys sitting and lying down on the job?
Yeah, you got to get a little dirty. Rachel had a nice line drive hit.
So who are the overambitious players? And now that from people that our audience might know, are there any a little too competitive people?
Passman. I'm sorry. Dan, you took it very seriously. I was saying at the bottom of the 50th inning, I was saying, Dan, you know what? If there's not another out, we're just us in the outfield. We're going to the bar. He said, there are plenty of people on the bench who would take your seat. I was like, ow, 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 ow.
I was in that dictator mode, but you know, when you have 18 people, you know, or 19 people you're trying to manage for 10 spots on the field, you know, you gotta take charge.
Sure, and they're all wearing the shirts that you had designed for them, and they're all playing with the equipment that you got for them.
Right, they're all marching in the way I taught them to march. It was beautiful.
Wait a minute, 10 spots on the field? What, you had a short fielder?
Yeah, in softball, there's 10 fielders.
Was there any of this? I'm not Dan, I'm Captain. Call me Captain.
El Capitan.
All right, well, I'm going to play next week. Thanks for stopping in.
Cool,
Ray,
sure. Thanks for having me.
Next week, we play Vanity Fair.
This is supposed to be good.
Real cream, man.
This is supposed to be good. Now, this is going to be a recurring thing. We're going to hear this every week. I heard those guys are great. So lower your expectations.
Cooks Illustrated, they rock.
Yeah. All right, we're going to be back. I did an interview with Bruce Wagner in Los Angeles a few weeks ago. He's one of my favorite writers, and we're going to play a few of you. When we come back, we're also going to talk about Social Security later in the hour. 12 past, Air America Radio.
Hi, this is former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, and you're listening to Mark Maron and Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
You know, the big problem here is somebody's going to win.
Barry Crimmins's Never Shake Hands with a War Criminal from Seven Stories Press.
You can read my book. There's more on it.
How are you? It's Mark Maron here. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. I'm here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Kalo's here. Larson, Clutch Larson, Dan Pashman, P.W. McDonald. We're all here. It's Friday. I'm excited that it's Friday. I'm going to play for you now. I was in L.A. a few weeks ago, as some of you know, and I was there for a week, and I sat down and had lunch with one of my favorite writers, Bruce Wagner. Some of you may be familiar with his books. He writes primarily about Hollywood. He's darkly funny. And a very, you know, philosophically challenging. And he's just, I love his books. He's written Force Majeure. He wrote the trilogy of Still Holding, I'm Losing You, and I'll Let You Go. His new book is called The Chrysanthemum Palace. Most all of them, as I said, take place in Hollywood. Most all of them are dark, but, you know, insanely funny. The new one, Chrysanthemum Palace, is shorter than the other ones. And if you don't know about Bruce Wagner, it's a great place to start. I'm Losing You is also a great place to start. But we sat down for and I had lunch with him, and now I know not to do lunch interviews because I talked to him for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And as you know, this is radio. We have 12 minutes. So and it took a while to render it. Bruce, if you're listening, that's why it's been a while. So here's my interview with Bruce Wagner.
I'm talking to Bruce Wagner. We are at the Pacific Dining Car in Santa Monica, California. Bruce is the author of Force Majeure, I'm Losing You, Still Holding, and I'll Let You Go. Did you think about calling one You're Breaking Up?
Did that? Many have been suggested to me.
I do. But I wouldn't be the first to do
but
that.
But none have been chosen.
Are you doing a fourth one?
No. For now, I'm finished with that so-called cellular trilogy, although all of my books, I guess, could be considered an extension of that.
I think there's only a few of you guys out there who do this type of writing that are able to really, you know, take a sort of insanely dark but yet comedic, you know, slice or cut into, you know, the soul of who we are, you know. I believe that to be true. But
well, that's very kind of you. I, you know, I'm, as my body work grows, you know, I'm very much, I consider myself to be a storyteller more than anything. I feel that you know, there's, you can have great high comic fun, and there is a fun to have a kind of as an exorcist in the exorcism of certain, or the lancing of certain wounds that one feels are universal, the wounds of humiliation or pomposity. But at the end of the day, I think that the goal for me is to be moved by my characters' stories and plights, just as that's sort of my daily goal. You know, the other day I was watching something on television, and it was a story, and there's been so many of these stories on television. There's so many kids with cancer that go on so many talk shows, and you start to feel rather cynical.
Mm-hmm.
You see them with their parents. You see the audience's response. It's almost schematized, you know, and And there was another story that I saw on the news of an older man who worked in a newsroom that had leukemia, and it was a miraculous recovery. They came up with a drug that reversed or turned off the switch of the leukemia. He found someone to give him a bone marrow transplant. It was a 1 in 5 million chance, et cetera. Mm-hmm. He came back to work, but not in the capacity that he had before. Now he reports on people that are overcoming disabilities.
I really thought that you were going to say, and he was shot and killed.
His wife was. He covers people that are overcoming disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a man who was a kind of a quadriplegic, able to use his hands, which were atrophied, in enough to type out words. And those words are transferred to a computerized mm-hmm. voice. And the man who was unable to speak typed in some words, and the computer said, "I am happy always." And there I'm watching this show, and I'm expecting just to fast forward or to be unmoved.
Yeah.
And I was really staggered by that.
That
I am happy always. And then you know, there's another story of a well-known story now of a doctor that was an ALS researcher that got the disease. And right when he got the disease, he knew what to do. He had a track installed in the ceiling of his bedroom, anticipating the day where his body will need to be placed in a sling when he needs to use the restroom.
Mm-hmm.
He bought the van of a former patient who is now dead that was already customized for someone that could not walk. His son returned from a fledgling career in the entertainment world to care for his father, to take his father to the bathroom. And the son said, "If you would have told me 2 years ago that I'd be helping my father go to the bathroom, I would have said no way."
Yeah.
So those kind of unexpected turns, those kind of novelistic turns,
sure,
are of great import to me. And that's what keeps me going, not like, how am I going to carve a new a-hole for this mogul or that agent?
But it doesn't read like that. And I don't want to mischaracterize. You know, I see, you know, throughout all the books, there is some sort of tremendous empathy for people who are in different stages of decay or handicap or disease.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think that, you know, you play that against the strange pride and vanity of other characters, and then, you know, usually there's an arcing sort of weird spiritual motif. It seems like all your books have a spiritual drive to them. You know, you find this moment, there's a place where these characters exist between comedy and tragedy that I find to be very engaging. It's a type, the laughter that you're going to experience when you read a book of yours is the laughter that, you know, could very easily crumble into crying.
Yeah. Well,
and
hopefully,
I like that.
I think that's sort of where we all live.
Yeah.
You know,
if you're awake and part of it.
Yeah. You don't know what the next moment is going to bring. I mean, to me, the absolute event of our lifetime will be, until something supplants it, the tsunami. Because of its mythological nature, it taps so deeply into our almost primordial brain. Every story that one reads from the tsunami has a mythological quality that is endlessly captivating, not for morbid reasons to me, but because of its profound resonance as in the ocean, so to speak, of story. It's a very unifying event for all of us, because it's here you have people on at least from the American perspective or the European perspective, because for the people that lived there, the ocean was their life. It gave them food. It gave them livelihood. But from our perspective, it's Christmas. It's vacationers,
right.
Tourists,
yeah.
and
pedophile junkets.
You know, all of this is truly comes to a head in the image, that terrifying image of that man looking out to sea as the waters recede, moments before the ocean in all its fury swallows him up. So we don't know what's going to happen as much as we fantasize that we do in the next moment. People die suddenly. We may die suddenly.
Yeah.
Those whom we love may die suddenly. So my books are an exploration of that, and they're also an exploration of triumph. But whether we have control over triumph or tragedy, I don't believe we do.
Yeah, you really don't. And, you know, and like when you think about, you know, I think that there is a momentum in culture, and oddly, so much of it is built here in Hollywood to protect us from ever really, you know, thinking about what you're saying. Thinking about that at any given moment, you know, something horrible could happen. Or at any given moment, the one cell that causes the revolution in your body to become malignant could happen.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Some upbeat stuff for Friday morning. But it turns around. You got to understand, you know, his books are profoundly funny. And I think what he's exploring is that as a writer, as a novelist, and as somebody who explores the human condition, this guy is really not afraid to go into not only the darkest psychological crevices, but also just the existential crevices that we deal with every day. I've been a fan of his for so damn long, and there I am sitting there for 2 hours. It was so funny because Brendan had to go through this through the interview and pick out some of the highlights, and I felt sort of bad because when you do a lunch interview, Riley, you got to know this, is that you do the interview, but you can't really say, all right, we're done with the interview, now we're just going to have lunch. So.
Now, we got a little more with Bruce Wagner, huh?
Yeah, we have some more. We have some more on the other side. He's going to talk a little bit about Hollywood, I believe, because that's really what drew me into his novels, was that no one tears Hollywood a new one. like Bruce, but he does it with a certain amount of humanity. I mean, he lets these characters crumble on their own, and it's very satisfying. If you like Nathaniel West, or you like Day of the Locust, or,
yeah,
or
sure.
That this is a great, great Hollywood satire. And we have, go ahead.
Yeah, well, no, we got part two of Mark's interview with novelist Bruce Wagner, and we may end up tearing a certain president a new one, too, when
good.
We come back here
good.
On Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
So join us here Sunday night on Air America Radio.
Revolution starts now.
Yeah, we're just enjoying the off-mic show here, 34 past the hour.
Somebody's recording that, right?
I hope so. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Man, the secret screaming id of Morning Sedition. Man, where's that show? We could run that on another network, fellas. We could definitely go up against Howard with that show. All right, so we're in the middle of a... We're in the middle of an interview I did with Bruce Wagner out in Los Angeles. Bruce Wagner being the author of the new book, Chrysanthemum Palace. His trilogy, Still Holding, I'm Losing You, and I'll Let You Go, also available. One of the great writers of the current generation of writers. Darkly funny, incredibly existentially provocative. Here he talks. He makes reference to Todd Solondz, who was in our studio not more than a couple weeks ago.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
His new film Palindrome, again, you know, existentially challenging and completely off-putting in certain respects, but brilliant. They tread in certain, you know, in somewhat of the same territory in terms of the dark side and the sort of, you know, the more humanly tragic elements of what we all go through and just human nature in general, and as far as generating characters that are troubled, disturbed, morally compromised. And they're friends. As a matter of fact, when I was talking to Bruce, I made him late to hang out with Todd, who was out in L.A. So here's the rest of that interview with Bruce Wagner.
You have a relationship with Todd Solondz, right? You guys are friends.
Yes.
And because I see that in some ways he does similar things, in that you create these characters that are emotionally handicapped or incredibly I don't want to use the word sad, but just broken or damaged or compromised in one way or the other, and you play with them. You know, but you, yeah. In order to
well, we that. Are them really. You know, I think that that's the key. You really do have to become all of your characters, and that means
in order not to mock them.
Yeah,
in a sense.
Because you have to become. You are them.
Yes.
You're the worst of them, and you're the best of them.
Right.
So Todd and I think have that in common in that because we are, for whatever image we have of ourselves or project to the world, we do. Feel this empathy with the damaged, you know, and because so much poignance comes from the damaged, and so much courage comes from the damaged,
and also so much you know, creativity and strange desires and mutations of originality and authenticity come from the damaged, and the enemy of that uniqueness. Is a lot of what we see in society today is mediocrity and religious fanaticism.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now the other thing that you just said, which just on a intellectual level that I find interesting, is just this need for these people that make such amazing amounts of money in this town, doing something that they rationalize as being creative or artistic, but obviously is just part of what is manufactured here in Hollywood, which is, you know, the illusion, the entertainment, that their need to feel valid and authentic in the world of art
mm-hmm.
is really accommodated by this desire to possess, this desire to put money into museums, into mm-hmm. paintings, into,
yeah, yeah.
you know, having these tremendous conveniences. Because I know that this town is built on this money.
Yeah. One of the best stories I heard was there was a man who was who tutored people on Shakespeare.
Yeah.
You know, I actually interviewed him once because I thought it was a wonderful idea for something.
Yeah.
And he this is someone that you hire, like
yeah.
you would hire someone to fix your computer, and he just breaks down the classics for you. You know,
comes over for an hour.
Yeah, and he becomes your tutor. Now that's a great idea, and there's nothing to laugh at about it. But if it's gone about with the same kind of lust that one covets. The new Bentley or, you know, the new objet d'art, then there's something perverse about it and ultimately comical, you know.
So you mean he's saying, you know, three or four women sitting around, you know, trophy wives or aging trophy wives.
Not even.
You know what I'm doing?
No, not even. Okay. It could be one person.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not even talking about a book club.
Right.
You know, yeah. Could be one person.
But bragging a trainer. About it. Bragging about it, though, to a friend.
Very, okay. Yes, but very... Very subtly.
Right.
It never stops that sort of permutation in Hollywood.
Yeah.
The number of things that one can do if one is inventive enough and has enough money to cadge or to in a buzzard-like fashion peck at the carcass of world culture is... it doesn't stop, you know. It doesn't stop. So... The one thing that comes to my mind is that are these trips that that people who have money can take to impoverished places to see what it's like to live that way. So they're very expensive.
Wait, you mean they pay to live?
Yeah.
Poor
No. They're
okay.
vacations,
okay,
basically.
Okay.
And part of the vacation is you visit a slum
Schweitzer
in
Airlines.
Rio de Janeiro.
Yeah.
Private jet.
Oh, okay.
And you know, so that to me, you know, that sort of under the aegis or guise of learning, one is actually doing something of astounding perversity.
Yes.
You know?
Okay.
One is being escorted in a kingly fashion to look at desperate people as one would pass through a low-end zoo, you know.
Sure, and this comes back to the false humility thing, is that they do it under the idea or the guise that, you know, they're learning or helping or being part
of. Well, you know, I do also want to be careful because, I'm I'm guilty of all of this myself. It's just that I
don't have the money that some people.
Yeah, and if I did, then I would be doing all those things. No, I you know, I think it's pretentious to say that I write to keep myself sane, or I write to avoid that fate. But no, you all of us are possessed of this false,
of course,
modesty, and
sure.
and it's just that. For me, it's those. Some of those targets are too large, so I need to look at myself as a target. In other words, I may be a large target, but not for myself, because we tend to not see the things in ourselves that we so greedily point to at others. So, if I can find subtle things, subtle behaviors that my characters are engaged in. And illuminate those, then that's a better thing for me to do than to point an arrow, close my eyes, you know, at a whole series of large targets and hit one or two of them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but in terms of Hollywood, I mean, let's talk about, like, I find, you know, I'm somebody who's been, you know, trying to, you know, deal with show business for years, you know, trying to get in and also assessing it. I was at the Comedy Store in the mid-'80s. I guess my question is I still feel like an outsider, and as you said earlier in our interview that you did as well, how much of this is fueled by an age-old contempt for this type of luxury on your own behalf?
Oh, none.
No?
No, because I enjoy that luxury as much as anyone. No, I was covetous. You know, I grew up on the wrong side of the tracks, but had so many friends.
South of Wilshire,
but I had so many friends north of Santa Monica or north of Sunset.
Yeah.
I developed a kind of bifurcate. I think this is why I'm interested in the double. I developed an absolute hunger and fixation on the moneyed, and to me it's an endless source of interest for me, as is those who are impoverished. To the point of obscenity. In other words, those two poles to me are absolutely riveting. So no, I'm not contemptuous at all.
That's great.
I have a lot of friends that that are kings in Hollywood. And to be outraged or upset by that is, I think, would be a futile and silly exercise. You know, it's everyone has their own fate and destiny. I'm just grateful for mine that I'm able to write what I want to write, unencumbered and you know, without being censored or edited, and that there seems to be a reading public for it.
I think that's a good place to end. We've been talking to Bruce Wagner. The new book is The Chrysanthemum Palace. I would recommend that you read. Do you call it an oeuvre? Is that what the entire Wagner?
I don't.
Oeuvre?
But you may.
Somebody use that word. Force majeure, I'm losing you, I'll let you go, and still holding. All great books. Thank you for talking to me today.
Well, God, it was a pleasure,
it's great.
Mark.
It's great.
Really a pleasure.
Well, there you go. That's Bruce Wagner. I do recommend you read some of his books. And now we're going to kick it off here in a second. We're going to talk about Social Security. We're going to talk about the blow monkey puppet king of the neocon. I don't even remember my own, what do you call it, anymore.
Uh-oh.
I'm sitting here listening to myself talking to Bruce Wagner going, wow, look at me fawning over the writer. Oh, my God, I'm embarrassed. But one of my favorites. I hope you heard it. Here we go. So we're going to come back in a second. We're going to talk about Social Security. We're going to talk about these new abortion rulings that are very horrendous in terms of reproductive freedom in this country. And as we say many times on this show, that as we are yelling about one thing, the Christian right, in terms of how they operate in the government, are diligently changing laws on a grassroots level that will, you know, ultimately compromise some of the civil rights of women in this country. And we'll get into that later in the show. It's 45 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You gotta keep them separated.
Hi, this is Reverend Barry Lynn from Americans United for Separation of Church and State, here to remind you that God and politics don't mix. That's why I get my God from the Good Book and my politics from Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
1-800-801-GAME. That's 1-800-801-GAME. Call now. 1-800-801-GAME.
Oh, my God. 50 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning Sedition. Man, if you only knew what went on in this studio when we're down.
Don't keep bringing that up. Somebody's going to want to really know, and then we'll all end up in jail.
All right. Well, you know what? We've got, I want to play this, and we've got, you heard about the reading series, the new reading series we've got? Could we hit that, Chris? No?
Next year, HarperCollins will proudly publish The Diary of Ronald Reagan. Morning Sedition has obtained these exclusive entries from the pen of the nation's 40th president.
October 15, 1982. Today at a briefing, a reporter asked my press secretary, Larry Speaks, about the gay plague. Larry said, "I don't have it, do you?" Everybody laughed and laughed. Well, ain't this funny? Uh-oh, there are trees outside my office. Those leafy culprits are responsible for 90% of the world's pollution.
This has been another excerpt from The Diary of Ronald Reagan, brought to you by Morning Sedition.
Hey, there you go. How's that? We got a few more of those coming through the hour. So let's talk about this, Riley. Let's get into this. The president spoke. He tried to stop programming for a while, but they wouldn't let him. About an hour into it, they're like, "That's it. Back to The Apprentice. Let's get back to things that people like. Let's get back to things that'll get us some money."
Well, yeah, it's funny the way the president deals with the television networks. Now, this is only the fourth news conference he's had since he became president.
Right.
And yeah, he wasn't sure at first. The White House didn't know that the networks were going to actually cover it. In a lot of cases, they shunt this sort of thing off onto their cable networks or whatever. If it's NBC, they put it on MSNBC. If it's ABC, God knows where they put it. And if it's CBS, God knows where they put it there either.
I had to watch it this morning, a bit of it on the TiVo. Thank God for the TiVo. I wouldn't know what the hell to do with this job because we got to go to bed early. But it seems like, from what I understand, he's not taking private accounts off the table. He is trying to make this presentable to people of lower income. After you explain it, I want to know what you think in terms of, you know, is this pitch for real, or is it a way to sort of bring in people who are of lower income into his world of where the rich rule everything and trying to fool them again?
Well, no, it's not really for people of lower income. It's for Democratic politicians he's doing this.
Mm-hmm.
See, people of lower income, Bush doesn't really care what they think one way or the other.
Clearly.
But he does need Democrats to get this thing done for him, and he knows that. So what he's doing is saying, and it's a really, it's not as difficult to parse as a lot of people might think. Here's the deal. Social Security right now is indexed. The increases in Social Security are indexed to people, to the national wage, median wage.
Okay.
What people make.
Right.
The plan that he's advocating now, the plan that he unveiled, if you want to call it that, last night, indexes Social Security benefits not to wages, but to prices for everyone except the lowest income Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the logic is that prices over time don't rise at the same rate wages do, which implies that for everyone but the lowest income workers, their benefits will be cut. Now, we are living in a very interesting time now, Mark, because for right now, wages are depressed and prices are actually wagging the dog right now.
Now, what would that mean in terms of his, let's say his Social Security plan was operational now? What would this imply?
That would imply that the benefit levels for middle and upper income workers would not be cut or decline as quickly.
Right.
Eventually, however, these things even themselves out, and they're gonna get socked. Middle income workers are gonna get socked by this. Let me show you real quickly how they're gonna get socked. Number one, the idea that these benefits will decline,
mm-hmm.
This is in addition to whatever benefit cuts you get if you invest in his private accounts. It's not like you got either one or the other. You get hit with a double whammy. If you decide to invest on the accounts, your benefits are cut. And if you're a middle-income wage earner, your benefits are cut. And a middle-income wage earner, let's look at this for people who are now 17 years old,
mm-hmm.
mere children,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
By the time they retire, there will be a 20% drop if they make the national average wage, which currently stands at $36,000. If your wages are a little higher, goes to $59,000, that benefit cut will be 30%. If you make more than $90,000, that benefit cut will be 40%. And that will be in addition to whatever cut comes because you invest in private accounts, although I don't know who in their right mind would do that if they were worried about a double whammy on benefit cuts.
Well, you know who would, it would be the people who like to gamble.
Yeah. Now, here's the ugliest part of all of this.
Yes.
They talk about, we have to fix this. This only cures 70% of the problem, which still leaves a gaping 30% that, they're going to have to find other revenue streams to close. By their own calculations, it doesn't fix everything.
And it's still a little bit confusing to me, and I imagine to most people. You know, I was told by people like Paul Krugman that this system is not in trouble. It may be a little, needs some adjustments that could be adjusted through, intelligent taxing that would correct the problems. But this seems to complicate things, and it seems that no matter who you are, if you're not filthy rich, you're going to lose something on the back end of this.
Well, if you are part of the struggling classes, which might be anybody from moderate to upper middle income, you're going to get hit.
Yeah.
You're going to get knocked. And people depend on their Social Security. People even in those struggling class income brackets, they depend on, they may not depend entirely on Social Security, but they do depend on Social Security to be a crucial part of their retirement net.
Yeah.
When they finish working. And under this plan, they're going to get less and less and less.
And then he says he's trying to bring people into part of the vision for his ownership society, which I see as a culture of debt, not an ownership society. Because as you said, now the private accounts, are they going to be a choice? Or are they implicit in the arrangement?
No, they're not a choice as far as Bush's plan is concerned. He wants the private accounts, even though he has admitted that private accounts will do little, if anything, to fix the problem. This is, as you point out, part of his ownership society spiel.
Yeah, but it will throw a bone to the investment community.
More than a bone.
Yeah.
More than a bone. It's a big
billions,
bone.
Billions.
They've been trying to downplay, the financial markets have been trying to downplay how much they'd make out if this plan goes through. But the fact is, they will make out like bandits if they have literally the investment savings of millions of potential retirees to play with over time.
So, I don't know. You think he's going to get the juice that he needs on this? I don't think so.
Absolutely not.
Good. Yeah, we'll be back. We're going to talk about some abortion rulings that are very disturbing. We're going to talk about the oncoming war of ethics between the Republicans and Democrats, and much more after this. Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. It's Friday. I hope everybody's doing okay out there. I feel all right. How about you, Riley? You feel all right?
I'm feeling all right.
If you're interested, I'm going to be in Cincinnati, Ohio at Go Bananas May 6th and 7th. So everybody who's listening to 1530 WCKY, the Revolution of Talk Radio, come on down and check it out. You can go to morningsedition.com to the tour dates page to get some info. Later in the show, Mick Ware is going to be with us, the Baghdad bureau chief for Time Magazine, a frequent guest on our show, one of the few journalists who has the courage to actually go behind enemy lines, develop relationships with the insurgents, and bring back some truth. This is only the second time he's actually been in studio with us. Very excited about that.
Yeah.
A little later in the show, Seth MacFarlane, the creator of The Family Guy, which is a very popular animated television show that was canceled many years ago, but because of the incredible fan base that made millions of dollars worth of purchases of the DVD, Fox is going to start broadcasting new episodes of The Family Guy on Sunday. We had a little conversation with him yesterday. But most importantly is the president, paying some lip service to this, broad-based idea of what Social Security should be. Don't think it's going to get passed. Do you, Riley?
No, I don't think it's going to. I don't think it's going to pass. He was under tremendous pressure to put some meat on the bones of his Social Security plan. He maybe put table scraps on the bone.
Mm-hmm.
He did not put a great deal of meat. He was asked a number of other things during this hour-long press conference, which, by the way, was moved back from from 8:30 to 8 o'clock so the networks could show their Thursday night primetime lineup, which, you know, coming up into the May sweeps, it's a very important time for the networks.
Yeah.
They don't have time to be putting, all of them to be putting this
going
on.
The Americans don't need to know about what the president thinks he's going to sell to the American people.
It's The Apprentice they want to see.
What's
or America's Top Model or something. I don't know. The Yankee game?
To those 70 million people out there that don't care one way or the other.
Well, he answered some other questions. Mm-hmm. He disagreed with Bill Frist in terms of saying, and of course that's the Senate Majority Leader, in terms of saying that people who are blocking judicial nominations are not people of faith and that they're victimizing people of faith. He contradicted one of his own generals who talked about North Korea's nuclear capability, and by the way, that general said, in essence, that North Korea has the capability to send a nuclear missile to United States soil. We're talking about Vice Admiral Lowell Jacoby's testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Bush says he really knows of no such thing.
Mm-hmm.
John Bolton,
mm-hmm.
He defended him, too. A blunt guy. I don't know what that means.
Well, that's all it means.
I know what blunt means on the street, but that's a whole different discussion. But, yeah, he said he'd be good for the United Nations, so he's backing him. So he's got a pretty good relationship with Russia's President Vladimir Putin, despite mm-hmm. some problems that he had with some of the things that Putin has done that supposedly... do away with liberal democracy in Russia, if they ever had it. He also said there's no timetable for the pullout of troops from Iraq like there ever was one. I guess he's just restating the obvious there. He says he doesn't pay any attention to polls, although if you look at his actions in response to certain polls, if you look at his actions the day after some polls come out, you might think he was fudging a little on that one.
Well, speaking of that, Riley, half of Americans, exactly 50%, now say the Bush administration deliberately misled Americans about whether Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. That's reported from Gallup this morning. Now, look, you know, if it's still only half, man, I'll tell you something. There's a lot of people out there that are stupid and like to be lied to and like to be, you know, taken advantage of and misled by their president because they assume that he knows best for them. That is so discouraging to me. I'm glad that half the people that were polled and now believe that he was lying because there's now pretty much substantiated proof that there weren't any WMDs just 2 days ago that said Syria wasn't hiding anything. So it's pretty much substantiated proof. Truth, i.e. truth, that we were misled by this president in the war, but 50% of the people in this country, or 50% of the people that were polled, refuse to acknowledge the lie, and they are submerged in some sort of strange denial in support of this president's lying. And a lot of people will forgive it. So they say, what difference does it make? We needed to go.
Yeah, I know. And we needed to keep 138,000 troops over there 2 years after we went. But
yes.
That's a whole other discussion for another day. This guy is not backing up off any of his... He even defended No Child Left Behind because, you know, even some states that went very heavily for him, like Utah, for
mm-hmm.
example, have problems. In some cases, they're prepared to make legal problems with some of those standards raised by No Child Left Behind. So, you know, he covered a relatively wide range of things and then said, well, I got to go, man. You guys got to show your primetime thing for the sake of the economy. That
yeah.
was his little joke at the end of the news conference.
So he ended with a joke. He did his
started
little,
with a joke in it, Social Security.
Yeah, the little George W. Bush form of endearing himself to the American people by, you know, saying, well, I'll just take off right now. I'm a stubborn lying bastard. But, hey, you know, enjoy your TV.
Yeah.
So, look, let's talk about this Child Interstate Abortion Notification Act. This was passed, the bill was passed 270 to 157. This was 2 days ago, right, on the April 27th. And it makes it a federal crime for any adult to transport anyone 17 and younger across state lines to have an abortion without the consent of her parents.
Hmm. Yeah, this is it applies to adults 17 and under, which is interesting because 17 is not a universal or a national age of consent in this country. In other words, there are some states that the age of consent is as low as 15. So I don't know exactly how this federal law. And by the way, I'm not sure that it's even going to pass the Senate at this point. The House has passed it. But these kinds of bills have died in the Senate before. But these are, Mark, those little incremental baby steps that the anti-choice movement has put their stock in trade in as
right.
far as the abortion
battle. Slowly chipping away at women's reproductive freedom.
Absolutely. And of course, the big prize for them is whoever replaces William Rehnquist on the Supreme Court. That's their end game here.
To overturn Roe v. Wade. But something like this, they're sort of taking advantage of kids in the sense of making a point about abortion legislation. Because in this legislation, it says that if somebody... If a child, you know, or whatever is the age of consent in any given state, goes to another state where the abortion laws are more laxed to get an abortion, that they are going to be held to the same standard of the state that they come from. And that they can be put into jail or face a $100,000 fine if an adult helps them facilitate this abortion. Am I understanding it properly?
That is correct. In other words, and by the way, this bill also imposes a 24-hour waiting period in some cases, even if the parent goes with the child to have an abortion.
Now, the doctor, that means that the doctor must contact the parents within that 24-hour period of time. Now, what about if they don't live with the parents, if they are they living in a shelter like this girl in Florida the government stepped in? What if they are, have been raped by their father or stepfather and the parent or guardian is not to be trusted in this situation? What if the parent of the kid who's pregnant wants her to have the baby because she wants another kid? What about all these gray areas in terms of the child making their own decision? It seems like this child, and this is the way the law is written, that if you have a legal guardian or a parent, that is your legal guardian or parent, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and one of the things that is I think really troubling about this 13-year-old girl in Florida is that she was staying in a state shelter. Now, how did she get pregnant while under the custody of Florida's State Department of Children and Families?
And what was the process that they used to block this abortion?
The Department of Children and Families actually countermanded the young girl's caseworker and asked a Palm Beach juvenile judge on Tuesday to block the procedure. They argued that she's too young and immature to make an informed medical decision.
But so why are they making a decision for her to have a child? This is what scares me, is that this chipping away at these abortion laws have pushed a lot of these, Planned Parenthood clinics, these counseling centers for reproductive rights have been pushed, aside or put out of business. So these kids don't have anybody to defer to. And as you said before the show, they're scared, they're going to seek these abortions one way or the other, or they're going to have a child that they can't bring up. And who's going to take responsibility for the child? When you take advantage of kids like this, kids should be able to talk to a grown-up that is unbiased and give them the advice that they need to make an educated choice about what their options are, and they should have those options.
Why is a 13-year-old child in the custody of the state? What is that child doing having sex? Assuming that this was not an immaculate conception.
She's probably an unwanted child herself.
Well, yeah, but there is a level of responsibility that the Department of Children and Families in Florida has that they're now trying to exercise after the girl gets pregnant. The girl got pregnant on their watch. Where were they? Why weren't they trying to intercede, or if the girl is in their custody, seeing to it that she's not having sex with people that are going to get her pregnant?
You see what you're doing, Riley. I'll play devil's advocate in a minute. You're clouding the issue that we're using to push through the legislation.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I miss something?
Well, no, that was what the other side argument. Those kind of things don't matter to the people that are trying to push this stuff through. I'd like to talk to some people out there that, what their feelings are. Obviously, when you're dealing with children, you're dealing with this is a different issue. This is not an adult that has the legal freedom to make their own decisions about having abortion safely, even if they are legal. These are kids that are subject to their parents anyways. So what is the parent's place in this? What do you think, 866-303-2270, this should be handled? Because obviously someone 13 years old who isn't a ward of the state should have an adult that they can talk to that isn't their parents, that isn't a religious advisor necessarily, that is somebody who can give them the information of what their options are and that they can do it safely. How should children be handled in this case?
Very good question. 866-303-2270 is our number. How would you handle this if it was your child?
Well, it's interesting because in Todd Solondz's new movie, Palindrome, this is exactly the issue, and he handles it in a very provocative way outside of the device of using too many actresses to play the same person. But it is the core of that movie. We'll be back with your calls after this.
Call us at 866.
Ha! That's awesome. Go on.
303.
Wow, yes. Yes, I love it.
2270.
Oh, yeah, drop the bomb. Drop it. There's not a dry eye in the house. Keep going.
That's 866-303-2270.
Okay, well, just so you know, it was good, but I was also being pretty generous.
This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
If you qualify to dramatically reduce your tax debt, call 800-661-0491 right now. That's 800-661-0491. Call right now.
Yeah, well, 22 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
We're going to be talking to you in just a second. I missed therapy yesterday because my therapist wasn't here, so now I'm all backed up. Here's my dream diary for today. I'm out in the woods in Wisconsin with my dead cat, Butch. I say, what the hell are we doing out here, Butch? Butch says, Mark Maron, we are spreading the cause of freedom. We come to a clearing, and there are hundreds of mangy, badass-looking cats. Some were humping, some had on leather jackets, some were smoking and chewing gum at the same time. Lots of tattoos, loose teeth, weed. Butch climbs up on a stump and says, comrades! They call you Pharaoh. I say you are heroes. And now the old men in the government with their sad, withered, testicle-like sanctions would exterminate you to appease the Elmer Fudds and the gun lobby. Well, the time has come for reckoning. It is at hand. Go. Run silent. Run deep. The cats disappear in a cloud of fur. Butch turns to me and screams, come, Mark Maron. The trees are bleeding. So we're creeping around and an empty beer can drops on the ground next to us. Butch looks up and whispers, bingo. We look up and there's a 300-pound hick with an ear-flap hat, and he's squatting a deer blind with his rifle completely hammered. Butch snuck up behind him silently and lifted one of his chins with a razor-sharp claw. Good morning, pancake. Hunting feral cats, are we? What do you say, Mark Maron? Should I take the claw to deflate his bloated man breast? Or should I climb inside this hunter once say and shred him like a Mexican party cheese? The hunter trembled and looked at me for mercy. Can't you control your cat, man? I just shrug and Butch says, no, he cannot. And that is the point. You cat blasting fat ass. Listen to your friends. Ah. All around the woods echoed the screams of hunters being slashed and gored and gutted. Butch says to the hunter, go. Tell your friends, these woods are ours. Then Butch slashed him across the belly and out came a thick stream of melted cheddar. I woke up and my bed was filled with nachos. Kind of a nasty bit of business at the end there, wasn't it? All right, here we go. We're talking to you about these new abortion laws, about the laws that basically give children, 14, 13-year-old girls, absolutely limits their choices, makes it more frightening, makes it more difficult for them to get reproductive advice or even reproductive treatment. And it's scary, and we just wanted to know from you, what do you think about the place of the guardian? What does that mean to be the parent, to be in charge of someone? What are these kids supposed to do when this happens to them? Pat, listening in New York, how are you?
Hi, Pat.
Hey. Hi.
You're listening to 1190 LIB.
Yes.
Okay.
My daughter was placed in a group home when she was 12 years old.
Mm.
She's mildly retarded.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's so many issues here. I mean, the abortion thing, the contraception thing, the guardian thing, it's just unbelievable. She's been molested 3 times in the care of the state of New York.
Oh, my God.
Really?
By caretakers, by group home, people who actually worked in the group homes where she lives, on trips that she was taken on.
Mm. They're doing time, these molesters, I hope.
No, of course they're not. Of course they're not.
That's awful.
None of them?
No, none of them. And they were. And we tried to catch one of them, but it was almost impossible. But anyway, she was molested. She did not become pregnant, but she certainly could have. And we had no recourse. We were not allowed to have her tubes tied, for instance.
Why?
Because the state says that when a retarded person reaches adulthood, that if we took any steps toward having her her tubes tied to keep her from getting pregnant, that they could be sued at a later date because she might say that she wanted to have a baby, even though she's totally incapable of taking care of herself.
But as her parent, as her legal guardian, those rules don't change when somebody is mentally challenged like that?
Not at all.
That is ridiculous.
Of course it is.
Yeah, it is.
But people are just starting to wake up. When you get into systems like this, that's when you start to realize just how restricted you are in taking care of your own child and the rights that you have.
And well, you know the scariest part of this? New York is considered one of the better states here.
Thank you for calling, Pat.
It's scary. It is truly, truly scary. And the scariest part of that is that whoever it is that molested her daughter is still walking around somewhere.
But that the parent is so powerless. I mean, you know, these are laws that are like on the surface trying to empower people to restrict, their kids from having any choices. But in a situation like that, I can't believe those laws exist. It's a completely different topic. It's definitely something worth looking into in the future. Well, I guess we're going to continue taking calls. There's a lot of people on the phone here. 866-303-2270. We'll be back in a second, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
That has been called a one-character tour de force. Join us this Saturday night, baby, on the Kyle Jason Show, only on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We're in conversation with you about H.R. 748, the Child Interstate Abortion Notification Act, making it a federal crime for any adult to transport anyone 17 and younger across state lines to have an abortion without the consent of only her parents. Alice, listening to 1190 WLIB in Westchester. What do you have to say on this, Alice?
Hi, Alice.
Hi there. I just adore you guys. I was going to say that one of the more insidious aspects of this bill is that neither grandparents nor aunts or even uncles can also be used. And I find that, first of all, in minority communities where a lot of grandparents wind up taking care of their kids, this will have an effect. But also, considering how far it is to have an abortion these days, I live in northern Westchester. The closest place is White Plains. In Mississippi, there are absolutely no places to have a legal abortion.
Very true.
You must cross state lines. And I think this is another way that these hypocrites are really going to get rid of abortion in this country.
Alice, you bring up an important point when you mention that in some instances, you're going to end up with dry state, wet state situations, particularly in the South, where there are very, very few abortion providers in some states.
Yes.
And it's going to have to be, now if it's not your parents taking you across the state line, a lot of people are going to end up being criminalized here.
Oh, of course. I think we need that cat Butch to help us deal with
that. Okay.
I'll get her on it.
Sharp.
Well, thank you for your insight, Alice. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
It's a very scary possibility because what's going to happen is that if God, if minors get pregnant and they're left without options, they're going to hurt themselves. They're going to seek out abortions where it's unsafe because they heard it from a friend or they know a place or, they're going to try it themselves with some sort of, herb or they're going to get, they're going to get depressed. Who the hell knows what could happen? It's just a very unsafe situation that could hurt kids over the long run, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, and what happens in a lot of these situations is that the child will try to hide the pregnancy from the parent.
Mm-hmm.
Wear tighter clothes, or not tighter clothes, looser-fitting clothes, and really not say anything. And then the longer they wait, the more dangerous the procedure if they do decide to do it. That's the real danger here.
So you think that this bill may not pass in the Senate?
I don't know that it's going to get through the Senate.
Okay.
I mean, they've tried this kind of thing before. Again, these are part of the incremental little baby steps that the anti-abortion movement is using as they wait for the day.
Well, we'll stay on top of it, and we'll see how that unfolds. Right now, the Bible's Book of Revelation portends the end of days and the second coming of the Christian Messiah, one of our president's favorite stories. Though no one knows when the end times will come, there are signs that will appear to men. Here on Morning Sedition, we won't let you get caught off guard by the end of the world. That's why we present this week's Rapture Watch with MILF Cardinal MILF, Dean of the recently disgraced Diocese of Denton, Texas. Your Grace.
Step lightly, ye perverted lilies of the valley, for ye are nothing more than sinners in the hands of an angry God, and your eyes have become the soiled looking glass through which we peer into the garish boudoir of Paul Abdul and your sagging fruits. Hide thy shame, blasphemers, for one day the Son of God will cometh down and punish the land of Hadrach, son of Askelon, brother to Ekron, in new improved Ekron with tech relief for added performance. And I promise thee that when he does cometh, everything will change it, especially the part it's about me arbitrarily having to put this annoying F at the end of certain words. As you all know, in the past I have often used Psalm 83, Isaiah 17, Daniel 9:27, and yes, even Ezekiel 38. To show how Syria's occupation of Lebanon would lead to a great war between Israel and the Islamic hordes, and thus bring about the tribulation, rapture, apocalypse, end times, and the final annoying issue of the Village Voice. But now, I got nothing. Because this week, the mother of all abominations occurred. Syria withdrew its forces from Lebanon. Ordinarily, I would decry this sign of peace as a huge setback to the forces of good and the number of hits my website gets. But fear not, there is still hope for the horrifying immolation of the world with its unclean beasts, including the panda.
Come on.
Pandas, horrible, unclean beasts. Using my Bible code software, version 6.6.5, wait till you see the next upgrade, I was able to eliminate all the spaces between the words of the Old Testament, so it revealed a continuous block of Hebrew letters. Then by skipping words at programmed intervals and inserting random verbs, nouns, and adjectives, I was able to observe certain passages in the book of Hosea, describing in detail the coming end time events. Mark, will you please read what I decoded?
Yeah, all right. Let me take a look, Cardinal. There was an egg-shaped woman who fly in a shoe. She had so many kumquats, she didn't steam engine what to bicycle.
End quotas.
Cardinal, what the hell was that? That didn't even make sense. What was that supposed to mean?
Very simple, Mark. God hates fags.
What? What are you talking about? What is that? You just did a Mad Lib. That was all that was. It was like a stupid Mad Lib.
Nonsense, Mark. Would the good people at Microsoft sell me a program that says God hates fags? I mean, think about it.
Oh, what makes you tick, Cardinal? How can you day after day immerse yourself in this nonsense and keep spewing out such despicable, life-hating dogma? I mean, how?
PMA, Mark. Positive mental attitude. That's how. If it weren't for the upcoming rapture, I'd live well into my 90s. But because I'm always happy and hopeful, and mark my words, heathen, this Syrian pullout is just a front for an attack on Israel. This glass is half full, fella. And soon me and a few of my golfing buddies will be sitting at the throne of Jesus Christ and his pet cockatoo, Stinky. Right. Until then, if I may quote the great John Edwards, hide your shame, Marin, for the excess and costliness of your apparel is a manifestation of great vanity.
What are you talking about?
In hell.
Oh, by the way, Cardinal? Vagitive? What is a vagitive?
I didn't say vagitive. I said adjective, you numbskull.
It sounded to me like you said vagitive.
Well, of course it would, because you're always thinking in that horrible manner.
No, what manner?
No, I think
get your mind out of the gutter.
I think vagitive is any word used to describe the vagina, effectively. No, I've heard that. I heard it on Sesame Street.
Whoa.
Vagitive! Don't you remember that?
I never watched television. It is the instrument of the devil.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah, all right. So you can have, what are you doing this weekend? Anything?
Oh, I got, I got a house cleaning party.
Come on.
Yeah.
You play any softball there, Carter?
I'm going to watch Iron Chef.
Oh.
Love Iron Chef.
I thought you just said you didn't watch television. It was cool with it.
Or is that live?
Not live, fella. I just TiVo it.
Oh, so you'll watch television on TiVo because...
Because
I caught you in a lie, didn't you?
Yeah.
You didn't I?
Yeah.
And now you're all confused.
Well,
how
much I fuck it.
All right, you take care, man. It's always good to see you.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
See you now.
We'll get to the vagitives.
Yeah.
You got to get off that, really.
Vagitive. It's a great word, vagitive.
Yeah.
Come on, that's going to be the theme of the show. Vagitives.
Yeah.
See, why don't you come back in a few minutes with some vagitives?
Well, you got to get all your vagitives and... I don't know.
It'll come later. You know, if you figure out something funny to say at the end of that, come back.
Go bananas, you hack. Go bananas? What is that?
It's the name of a club.
Yeah.
Do you remember when you used to do comedy back in the day?
Yeah.
That's okay. You couldn't do it on your own, but the team thing worked for a little while. You want to play, Earl? Come on.
I saw you at Stiffy's in Stockton. That was a great night.
Yeah. Thanks for opening for me. All right, take it easy.
You held a great raffle.
Yeah. And the riffs just keep on coming.
That was San Francisco style.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So are we going to get into this story? Is there any way when we come back we'll have a few minutes to talk about the upcoming ethics war within the House?
Yeah.
Because, you know, as I said yesterday, I was a little concerned that Denny Hastert was so quick to say, okay, we'll make the rules what they were. I'm like, what does that mean? These guys never do anything altogether if there's not something going on. We'll talk about it when we come back, 43 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition on the air. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
Experts now, 800-396-9711, 800-396-9711. That's 800-396-9711.
Forty-eight past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Air America Radio's Morning Tradition program. We will have Family Guy, Seth MacFarlane, momentarily. Quickly, we want to address, though, that the ethics rule change, when changing it back so the ethics committee can function as we expected, meant more than just the, you know, like, okay, we're going to give you delay. You know, what it means is that these guys are going to come at the Democrats in the House with a full-on, you know, kind of like, we're going to find out who's breaking the rules on their side.
Yeah, and the first person, excuse me, that they appear to be targeting is Washington Congressman Jim McDermott, who was actually the target of a complaint that was filed in the last Congress by Congressman David Hobson from Ohio, alleging that McDermott leaked sensitive ethics panel material. Now, what this means, Mark, is that they're not just going to talk about trips paid for by lobbyists or any of the rest of this. What they're going to start looking at is every Democrat's actions with a fine-tooth comb. Now, the Democrats know this already.
Yeah.
That's why you've got guys like Steny Hoyer and the rest of these people running around making sure that each I is dotted and each T is crossed in terms of their trips and in terms of who paid for what, because they don't want to get delayed, as it were.
Yeah, so get your books together, Democrats, and thank you for staying strong, because this does also mean it is important to realize that the Democrats are coming together, you know, in both houses and making some points and pushing through an agenda. So right now, yesterday, Mark Riley and I talked to Seth MacFarlane, whose show Family Guy is going to be back on Fox with new episodes starting Sunday after an amazing amount of grassroots support in the form of people buying their DVD. And I never knew about it, but P.W. McDonald and Dan Pashman are fanatics. So here's Seth MacFarlane. Good morning, Seth MacFarlane. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. I got to be honest with you, I never knew about Family Guy until a couple of our producers, who are fanatics for the show, I mean, literally, it was like a religious thing. They could not believe I had not heard of it or had seen it. So I had to take home, you know, a bunch of episodes and sort of do my homework on this, like, months ago, right when I met these guys. So now it's back on network TV after it was canceled years ago. What did it feel like to have them call you back, and what was the story behind that?
Well, the story behind it was that the show had, you know, because of this new market of TV to DVD releases, it had had a chance to build an audience that other shows don't have. I mean, you know, in this day and age, if a network show is not a hit, you know, within the first few weeks, it's ready for the chopping block. Because of the DVD market, Family Guy was able to build this audience after it was canceled. And, you know, it took a good year or so. They called me in for a meeting and they said, we'd like to put this thing back into production, which was a complete surprise.
So people like Brendan and Dan Pashman, guys I work with, little, you know, adepts of the Family Guy, little minions, Family Guy minions, are out there in the world saying, this is the best show ever.
Yeah, apparently. And apparently there were enough of them. And also because of the reruns on Cartoon Network, you know, cable is obviously a big player now. Fans were able to protest the cancellation of the show with their Nielsen boxes and their wallets, and not just by writing letters.
Seth MacFarlane, you are going to be here in New York, and you're going to be doing something called Family Guy Live. You and other cast members are doing a live version of an animated show. How does that work?
Yeah, somebody asked me the other day, what do you guys use, puppets or something? We basically do we do what we do every week with the show. I mean, when we finish a script and just do a live reading of it to kind of see what jokes are playing and what jokes aren't. That's pretty much what we're doing in New York.
How many characters do you do on the show?
I do Peter, Stewie, and Brian, the father, the baby, and the dog. And
but that's pretty distinctly different voices.
Yeah, yeah. It keeps me hoarse.
So when you do a live reading, if there's dialogue in between those three, do you have to just go back and forth between them without much of a pause if it's live?
Oh yeah, and that's that's actually kind of second nature at this point.
So you can drop into any of them right away. Like you could give me the dad if you wanted to.
Yeah. I mean it's you're prompting me, aren't you?
A little bit.
That's the easy part. The hard part is trying to do that with about 15 beers.
That's great.
Seth MacFarlane, Fox has aired reruns of the first three seasons of Family Guy recently, and they made a couple of edits from the original telecast, including one where they censored the image of Peter's naked butt. Are you at all nervous that, the times have changed such that there's a different standard now? And how did you feel about the censoring of a butt in a cartoon?
Well, I don't entirely... It's interesting. The more I think about it, part of me thinks that maybe that was a deliberate action to kind of flag for people exactly what it was they were dealing with and just to kind of get the press to come out and say, whoa, this is absurd. The strange thing about it is, I mean, we were seeing Homer's naked butt in 1989, when The Simpsons premiered.
So that Homer broke the butt barrier initially.
Yeah, I mean, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, are people suddenly prudish? I don't think so. I mean, I think television is an easy political target. It always has been. I am a little nervous, as I think most of Hollywood is nervous, and I think a lot of people outside Hollywood who are aware of what's going on are nervous. It's, it's just disquieting that we have to sort of start worrying about what the government is going to think of what we're writing. I mean, that's a little unnerving to me. I think it's unnerving to a lot of people in the business.
Well, it's horrible because it forces people to second guess themselves on behalf of this weird sort of not so silent majority of, of religious fanatics and conservatives who, like you said, want to politicize television.
It's bizarre to me that the conservatives are not the ones saying, "Hey, this is America. This is the land of free speech." But I think look, it's all about balance. I mean, television, if left to its own devices, could go too far, and there could be a hypothetical point at which an organization like the Parents Television Council serves a purpose, and it's like God knows, if reality show, there's the old fear that reality shows are going to go so far that they're going to start televising executions. Well, obviously at that point, probably the
government would approve that. Are you kidding? George Bush likes nothing more than to execute people.
Yeah, well,
he's done it more than almost any governor in the United States.
Yeah, I mean it. It's so hard to tell whether it's whether it's a political tactic. There are things that we can't do that we use. I mean, poop jokes. For some reason, poop jokes are
the new no-no.
Exactly. I mean, you can't even so much as show somebody on a John, even though we all gotta poop sometime. I mean, it's no use keeping it a secret. And I think what people forget is that the old cartoon shorts in the 30s and 40s, I mean, those were made for adults at the time. And, this is a show, we write this show for adults. I don't know how many kids are getting all the Bob Hope references.
And speaking of history, what were your primary influences, if you could?
I mean, for this show, certainly, things like The Far Side, certainly that The Simpsons influence every animated show out there. I mean, my personal taste run a little old-fashioned, believe it or not. Love the old Hope Crosby movies. You know, Jackie Gleason was probably as big an influence for Peter as anyone.
Okay, well, you know, I'm glad you guys are back on the air. I'm looking forward to the new season. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks.
All right, you betcha.
I'm going to have to watch it, Riley. We're back here now. This is live, real here.
Oh,
now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to have to watch it. I watched, like, one episode because Pashman, right when I got here, it was almost like I failed a test with Dan Pashman. He threw a DVD of The Family Guy in my face and said, do you know about this? You got to watch this. And I couldn't get through it because I'm not an animated guy, but I'm going to have to, you know, really take some time and get to know it a little better because I watched it, you know, eventually watched
what
a few
time?
Of them.
It's on at night, isn't it?
It's going to be on at night, but I'll tape them. Because I watched a few of them, but I'm not a huge Simpsons guy, not because I don't think it's genius. I just don't interact with cartoons that well.
Yeah.
But in order to talk to him, I familiarize myself a bit. But I need to change. I need to change, Riley. Hey, this is in code. This is special code. Krieger, hungry. Is it happening? Krieger, we love you.
Ugg Day.
Where's
Airway
that?
Is the Ood Face.
Yeah, City Bakery. Is that happening today? Do we have to get on the air and question it every week?
No.
All right, we're going to be back with the dog of the week. We got Mick Ware coming. Very excited from Times Baghdad Bureau in town for the second time. He's going to be here in the studio. We talked to him many times. We're going to really know what's the truth about Iraq after that.
That's right. We'll be back. This is Air America Radio.
That's right, 6 past the hour. It's Morning's Edition here on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives for reasons that are their own. Who knows? Maybe looking to get angry, maybe looking to hear something that'll change their mind. Riley, I'm a little nervous right now.
Why?
Because I'll tell you, I got to go interview Nick Nolte later this afternoon.
Oh, wow.
Hopefully it'll be, you know, we'll put it on the air, but who knows? Man, how you doing?
Yeah.
But I'm excited because he's one of my favorite actors. Great personality.
You know, his niece used to work for, actually, I met some years ago because she used to work for a syndication service.
Oh, really?
Some people here used
to.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Jennifer, I think
uh-huh.
her name is. Well, nice kid.
It's one of those things where it's like he's a guy I've looked at and watched all my life. He's done some great roles, and I'm going to have to be sitting there with my mini disc going, so, Mr. Nolte, how about that time you were, you know, what's your favorite thing to do when you're on the set? Hey, how about the, you know, what are the high points in your career? But I'm looking forward to sitting down with him.
That ought to be fun.
I just want to feel the energy. The Nolte energy. So, you know, sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, as some of you know, we've got the machine. The iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. I was about to say feed it some intros. Let's feed it some intros. From the New York Times, House overturns new ethics rule as Republican leadership yields. House overturns new ethics rule as Republican leadership yields. Translation, regrouping, GOP drops ethics battle to focus on killing judges. Yeah. From Associated Press. Wins $2.7 billion Vegas hotel casino opens. Wins $2.7 billion Vegas hotel and casino opens. Translation, crowds flock to play Social Security Pie-Gow. From ABC News, Southern Comfort Museum coming to New Orleans. Southern Comfort Museum coming to New Orleans. Translation, recession-weary South finally succumbs to liquor-based economy. Yes.
Nice.
Well, you know what time it is now, Mark Riley. I think everybody knows it's Friday. It's that time of the week for... Mark Riley's Dog of the Week.
Thank you very much, Mark. This week's dog really ought to be called the Cat of the Week. Okay, several cats.
Yo.
Really big cats. We're going to try to tell the story without grossing you out, but it won't be easy. The dog of this week is a South African farmer named Mark Scott Crossley. A judge Thursday ruled this guy and an accomplice murdered a former employee in a most grisly way.
Mm.
They literally fed him to lions while he was still alive. That's right, like he was a wildebeest you see in those nature shows.
Oh.
Awful. Death didn't come quickly for Nelson Chissell. 23 witnesses gave evidence. The murder took 6 hours. In a twist of fate, it took the judge 6 hours to deliver his ruling. The murder last year caused a firestorm in post-apartheid South Africa. Farmer Mark Scott Crossley is white. His victim was black. The case brought back allegations that white farmers routinely abused their black workers. There's no doubt that was the case with Nelson Chissell. Investigators found little more than his skull, a few bones, and a finger in the enclosure where he was killed. Mm. And what was the sin Chissell committed to warrant such a grisly murder? He complained about Scott Crossley to the local Department of Manpower and alleged to police his property was burned by the farmer. Scott Crossley and his accomplice face sentencing beginning August 10th. The judge says it may take as long as 3 days. He faces a mandatory sentence of life in prison unless he can prove substantial and compelling reasons for the court to decide otherwise. I can't think of any. Can you? Mark Scott Crossley, man. You're an animal. In this case, the Morning Sedition, Dog of the Week.
What a nasty story, man.
Yeah, it was, but it had to be told.
I'll say, that's just horrendous. Just horrendous. I'm looking forward to our guest. So after the break, you know, let's go ahead and report this, because we're going to talk about it with him when he comes in. You know, President Bush mentioned Iraq. You know, we've been talking a lot about Iraq all week in terms of, you know, how it's being represented, what's going on with the insurgency, how it's being covered, why the numbers of Iraqi troops are being killed are so high and so few Americans, which is a good thing. It's not good for anybody to die, but it's interesting that the face of the dead is starting to change. I'd like to talk to Mick about that.
Oh, yeah.
We've got a report right here in front of us that just came in.
Nine car bombs and two roadside bombs exploded over a three-hour period.
And this is the day after they chose their cabinet.
Yeah. Now, this started just after midnight Eastern time. In and around Baghdad, 24 people at least dead, at least 98 others wounded. Seven of the bombings were suicide, but the death toll does not include the insurgents. And again, we see this kind of coordinated strike. And what were the targets? Again, Iraqi police, Iraqi security, Iraqi soldiers.
And we also got to talk about Mick about the phrase civil war, which is no longer a taboo to talk about in Iraq. So why don't we go out now and come back with Mick, because we're gonna have we'd like to have as lengthy and in-depth a discussion as possible. It's 12 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people
on Air America Radio. Thanks.
Support our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Operation Truth. We were there.
Paid for by Operation Truth, Incorporated.
Next year, HarperCollins will proudly publish The Diary of Ronald Reagan. Morning Sedition has obtained these exclusive entries from the pen of the nation's 40th president.
July 25th, 1984. Everyone's making fun of Ron Jr. being a ballet dancer. Sure, he's wispy and frail and womanish, but what they don't know is I found him having Congress with a playboy in the washroom. And more than once. Sure, he was tucking his equipment between his thighs, holding giant feathers aloft and shrieking, "I'm a beautiful swan," but... ooh, okie dokie. He's on his own now, just like Patty. Uh-oh. Mommy's coming.
This has been another excerpt from The Diary of Ronald Reagan, brought to you by Morning Sedition.
17 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
You're going straight to hell.
It's Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. It's so funny because Mick Wire's sitting there going, is this real? Is this? Oh, no. This is a comedy piece.
Sing plausible.
With us now, Baghdad Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. Mick Wire has talked to us many times from Baghdad, once here in the studio. It's a pleasure to have you back. You had some trouble getting here?
Yeah, I'm geographically challenged.
The poor guy drove all around New York because there were so many numbers in there. You had the 41st floor, you had the 34th Street intersection, you had the address. But I guess one thing you didn't hear was... that had to be relieving. interpreting that that was that wasn't part of your experience in New York.
Sounds just like him.
Oh wow,
oh, man! So we've got a report here that that up to 24 people have died in six car bombs in Baghdad. Now
nine
car bombs. And last night, our president, when asked about General Myers' statement about the insurgency, said this last night.
Your top military officer, General Richard Myers, says the Iraqi insurgency is as strong now as it was a year ago. Why is that the case, and why haven't you been more successful in limiting the violence?
I think he went on to say we're winning, if I recall.
If he recalls. So, Mick, what is...
There's an answer for you.
Is the insurgent... It seems like they're a lot more planned and articulate in the types of attacks they're doing, and that's been characterized both as desperate and as strength. What do you see it as?
Look, we're on a long continuum here when it comes to the insurgency. And I don't know who's talking to the president, but his men in uniform on the ground, his generals... are under no illusions. They know what they're still up against, and they barely put a dent in it. And I actually find it amusing when I'm sitting in Baghdad and read the news from back here in the States, and people are talking about, oh, a lull in the attacks, and the insurgency's on the back foot, and all this sort of business. I mean, the attacks never stopped, but they have their own natural rhythm, their flow. They come and they go, and what we notice is generally they have a regeneration period of about 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
That's what military intelligence tracks. That's what I track. So post-election, we're pretty much on the money right now for a whole new spate. And you're right, they're much more sophisticated. And that's being very heavily noticed in Baghdad.
In terms of, like, there are distractionary tactics, there are main attacks, there are, you know, diversionary elements.
Totally. Look, I'll give you an example. There was, not so long ago, a very serious attack on Abu Ghraib prison.
Yes.
You know, a deeply symbolic target. I mean, there's myriads of reasons why they would choose that. Now, it's been mortared before and it's been shot at before, but this was the real deal. Now, I had a briefing from some very senior American commanders about this, and they said if you set an exam paper in a war college on how to conduct this attack, you couldn't have done it any better than this. I'll give you an example. It started at about 6:30 with what's called isolation. That means all the routes leading to Abu Ghraib prison had IED attacks, small ambushes, anything to stop the flow, anything to stop people coming in to assist. So on all corners of the compass, it was sealed, more or less. Half an hour after that began, comes the preparation fire. And it wasn't just an odd pod, you know, mortar coming in. As I said, it was echelon fire. It started with rockets. Then it progressed to 82-millimeter mortars. And then it came down to 60-millimeter mortars. While this is going on, gunmen start engaging the guard towers. Then after 30 minutes of that, the car bombs start coming in. Now, we have engineers who will do a breach into a building or across a train track or like this. They don't have that. They use car bombs. The car bombs targeted two of the corners of Abu Ghraib prison. The idea was for them to breach the wall. Now, that didn't happen, and that was significant. But as those car bombs went in, there was infantry assaults. And
foot soldiers?
Yeah, yeah. So those two infantry assaults totaled, what I was told, about 50 to 70 men. In total, the entire operation, from the isolation to the support fire, we're looking at 100 to 200 guys. Now, this was under the behest of Zarqawi. It was done in his name by his organization. But interestingly, the commanders from intelligence who were talking to me said, we realize now that it was planned by a Republican Guard colonel who had the assistance, we believe, of a Syrian military intelligence officer.
Really?
And it was by the numbers.
Wow. So that means that there's a lot more people involved in that. Because you've always characterized the insurgents, and we have as well, as a combination of jihadists, Baathists, angry Iraqis that may not have been insurgents before, but because of what's happened in their country, they are doing that now. But now you're saying that there are Syrian military operatives working with the insurgency actively?
Absolutely. And that's been the case almost from the beginning. I mean, as you accurately described, Mark, there's a two-track war, a terrorist war and a guerrilla war, the day-to-day drip feed of attacks and bombs and ambushes, this sort of thing. Both of those channels are supported by other countries, particularly Syria. Syria has a long connection to the Ba'ath Party. I mean, there's the Syrian Ba'ath. I mean, quite frankly, I can go and visit top Ba'ath commanders in Damascus if I want.
Really?
Absolutely. Zarqawi's chief financial officer, according to the U.S. administration, sits happily in Damascus, and no matter how much we scream about it, he's still there untouched. So money and men flow in and out through Syria. Now, in Fallujah, I actually encountered Syrians. Now, some of them were just the faithful who came to fight. Others, they had a military bearing, let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. Oh,
and the insurgents, when I talked to them at one point about, well, your DVDs, your footage, it's becoming much more sophisticated. Your software is pretty, you know, on the money and this sort of thing. They said, well, the Syrians taught us how to do it.
Really?
Yeah, that was this particular element I was talking to. Zarqawi's propaganda machine is modeled much more closely on the Al-Qaeda propaganda machine, Al-Sahab Video Productions and these people. It's just classic. But I remember one day when I took a Zarqawi tape to CNN, they popped it in the machine and looked at it, and the production guy sat back and went, dude, this is made on the same software suite that we use.
Incredible. Mick Ware, we see again in these latest attacks that police and security forces in the military are the targets over and over and over again. A three-part question. Number one, does this have any impact on recruitment? Number two, is there any impact of this, quote, de-Ba'athification of the military? And number three, I seem to remember some NATO countries that were promising to train the Iraqi troops. Are they, in fact, doing so, or is that responsibility principally falling on America?
I'll take the third part. Okay, recruitment. Okay, this is an important thing. I mean, like I just mentioned, 3 months to basically regenerate. When you lose a lot of guys, a lot of leadership, you train them back up. I've got some amazing insights into how they do that as well. The significant thing, apart from the speed and the regularity with which they can do it, there is no shortage of volunteers. There is a deep, deep pool. I'm not sure if I've shared this with you before, but I've got a friend of mine, an Iraqi, who whose life just became a mess, his personal circumstances. He became dejected. So he turned looking for something, and he turned to the jihad. Now, fortunately, he's come back from that. But
was this a phase?
Yeah, kind of was. And I suspect this happens to a number of people. It's like, you know, adolescence gone wrong. But when he came back, he said to me, I went and volunteered to be a suicide bomber. And he said, you know, connected through a mosque to an organization. And they said, listen, God love you. We appreciate what you're doing. But our roster's pretty full right now.
Wow.
We can only produce so many devices.
Wait a minute, a waiting list for suicide bombers?
Yeah, so they said to him, this particular organization said, look, just go home, keep praying, be a good boy. You know, we've got your name. When we need you, we'll come and tap you on the shoulder.
This friend of yours, though, was that what he was going for, that he had become so depressed? He said, to hell with it, I'm going to go, I might as well blow up for a reason?
Yeah, I mean, this guy was a Ba'athist with whom I could sit down and have a beer, right? And then, like a lot of people who I've encountered over the last 2 years, he slowly gravitated towards the more religious vein. And then when other circumstances in his life deteriorated, it made him prone to this.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the recourse he sought to apply.
So his political ideology to go and blow himself up in a bomb was sort of like, she left me, Nick.
Yeah, kind of like, she took the boys.
Oh, my God.
Unbelievable. That's a fascinating thing. We're going to talk more. We're running out a little bit of time. I don't want to get you stuck. We've got to hold another segment. You're going to hang out for a while. But which other issues are we going to cover when we come back?
Well, I want to talk about the whole issue of the NATO countries, where they're actually training any of the Iraqi troops they said they were going to train. And again, this whole idea of de-Ba'athification, which is something that Ahmed Chalabi is pushing very, very hard. The CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, pushed it real hard before. So we'll get that and a lot more with Mick Ware when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Good comes of that, and that's what is happening now. It is disgusting.
Jerry Springer on Air America Radio.
So
34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
This morning's edition on Air America Radio. We're talking to Time Magazine's Baghdad Bureau Chief Mick Ware about Iraq. We were waiting for some food, but Clutch Larson's been demoted. He's no longer Clutch Larson. He loses his nickname because he's an ass.
Oh, wow.
Didn't get our food.
Uh-oh.
You know what I'm saying, Mick. You expected some food.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
An army marches on its stomach. Not mine does.
Exactly. So we were in the middle of some questions here, Riley.
All right. I just wanted to get a sense of what impact the debathification or the potential debathification of the Iraqi security forces will have, and also whether the NATO countries that promised to train the troops are in fact doing so.
Right, well, let's deal with NATO. There is a NATO contingent there that's now heavily involved in the training program. That program is still overseen by General Petraeus, the very successful American general who was promoted after his time in the northern city of Mosul. Training, of course, is the ticket out. Ultimately, that's the plan. We've seen a significant shift in that program, though. What we're now doing, as opposed to the past, where it was train them up, uniform, teach, make sure they know how to shoot, and then push them out there. It was like fire and forget weapon, yeah. Right?
Oh, wow.
They just turn to pieces,
right.
You know, as soon as you walk away. Now what we're doing is we've gone back to Vietnam, the MACV program, the Military Assistance Command Vietnam
the advisors.
Program. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, yeah. You remember all those Vietnam photos where you see a paddy field, a string of South Vietnamese troops, and one or two Americans walking behind them? That's what we got in Baghdad.
Is that why the numbers are so high now? Because one thing I noticed, and we read some piece by Coburn, who you know,
Patrick Coburn, yeah.
Patrick Coburn, yeah. And his assumption, well, he said something different, but when I was looking at the numbers, I'm like, clearly there's not as many as American guys, American troops engaged in this. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. At this stage, they still haven't stood up as many as American troops are there, although they always, the figures are notoriously rubbery. You've always got to take it with a grain of salt. Let's just look at the military, the army.
Yeah.
There's roughly 90 battalions that have been stood up. How many are effective? That's a very closely guarded secret. Some people say as few as 8 or 10.
Out of 90?
Yeah, so maybe 15 or 20 at best. Not even 20, trust me.
Okay.
So,
that's like, ooh, just over 20%.
That's what I'm saying. 20% is not the figure. It's less than that. So it is a long, dark road.
But is it still because of mixed loyalties, of fear, of tribal retribution?
Absolutely. It's a whole host of things. Lack of leadership. It is mixed loyalties. I mean, look what we've just seen recently in the last few months. We've seen both sides of the internal Iraqi conflict, the Sunni and the Shia, call for their followers to join the armed forces. Hello, why is that?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Geez, boys, you know, what do you think's about to happen? And this brings us to debathification. This, ladies and gentlemen, is make or break stuff. Debathification, this incoming Shia-led government. Man, they got blood on their mind. I mean, these guys were hurt for decades. Their families were oppressed. The society was repressed. You know, they want some payback. Now, you can't blame a fellow for that in these circumstances. But what the situation now demands is real statesmanship. The parties coming in before the election, during the election, and since the formation, until the formation of the cabinet, were saying we're going to expand debathification. Interior Minister is full of Baathists. Defence is full of Baathists. The command structure, intelligence, we're going to gut every single last one of them.
And that's what the CPA wanted to do, right? The Coalition Provisional Authority?
Well, yes, that rather ill-advised organisation. Thank you, Paul Bremer, the loser medal. that's been, US policy on that has changed.
Yeah.
There's now a realisation that debathification as it has progressed is not going to work. It's going to undermine everything that the U.S. has tried to build. The expertise and the structure is going to be pulled away.
And also in the U.S., this administration is not afraid to use ex-war criminals in its administration if they're effective.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And look,
whatever works.
Look, I've got some amazing conspiracies about what's going to happen in the future here, but if you look at it.
That's another show.
Yeah. Hello.
We'll have to have you back, man.
Yeah. One thing is, let's look at whose interests align here. You've got a Shia-led government coming in with long, close, and very real ties to Tehran. You've got the Baathists, who in the 80s in the Iran-Iraq war were American allies, who are receiving enormous American assistance. The Baathists, if anything, are seeking a secular democracy. They're willing to horse trade and do deals. At the end of the day, who do you think U.S. government policy most closely corresponds with? The Baath?
Ooh,
or the Shia?
Or the Shia, yeah.
Now, Who was it who opened secret negotiations with the Ba'ath insurgents? It wasn't the Iraqi government. It was the U.S.
government.
Right? Now, what they're trying to do now is trying to convince or counsel the new government to move away from this course of rabid de-Ba'athification. But quite frankly, they're not listening. And there's no real measures that the U.S. government can bring to bear. They talk about carrots and sticks to nudge them down the path. But so far, these guys, the incoming government, reckon they're impervious to it. So de-Ba'athification is about to become a very valuable barometer of U.S. influence in Iraq. Its fate will tell us about the fate of U.S. influence. I did an interview, the last interview with a Western journalist by Prime Minister Alawi. Now, he said to me at that time, he said, you're about to see American influence reduced to almost zero.
With 138,000 troops?
Well, as Tehran recently said, or last year said, that means 138,000 potential hostages just across our border, which is bold talk. But you know, these guys are an independent sovereign government. That's what the international community, led by the U.S., has created. So theoretically, whatever decisions they choose to make, you know, you have to stand back and let them. And they still take their support from Iran, not from Washington.
Not from Washington. Now, let's say that for the sake of argument that America does have influence and that the de-Ba'athification process is halted in its tracks. And we see the inclusion of, what, six Sunnis in the cabinet ministry. Those two developments together are not enough to stop the insurgency?
Ah, no way. No way. I mean, we need to see a whole host of measures. We need to see real engagement with the Sunni community. We need to see a real outreach program. And in fact, this government is promising to do just the opposite. They want the American negotiation process that's begun. The incoming government has said, we want no part of it. We don't want to deal with these people. We want to go out and kill them. We've shown that that's ineffective. We cannot simply do that. So it's not going to be an easy solution like that. And let's have a look at this cabinet. The Sunnis ain't happy. They've got six, more likely four, ministries, including the Ministry of Tourism. Hello. Are you lining up to visit Iraq?
Things are picking up, aren't they?
Yeah, and we're about to see there's threats that the command structure of the armed forces are going to change. Anyone who's a Sunni, anyone who's a Ba'ath, you're out of there. Well, these are the guys that the American military has been training and working with. And that's why Rumsfeld had to go in and try and kick heads in a surprise visit a couple of weeks ago. Now, the Shia government said all the right things, but, you know, when I talked to them. I talked to them just before I left last week, and they said we're coming for them.
Wow. So let me ask you a couple of questions. First of all, it seems that there is a thriving tourist industry on the jihadist tourists that buy one-way tickets to Iraq.
Plus it's from Syria.
But the question that's sort of throbbing in my head is if they follow through with this de-Ba'athification, the possibility for civil war is almost imminent. It's going to happen.
Well, this will be... This is one of the triggers. There are other factors as well, and nothing is clear-cut. De-Ba'athification alone may not do it. But put it this way, as I've been moving through the Iraqi military in recent months, and I've been spending quite a lot of time with them, and to some degree with the U.S. advisors. Now, the Americans won't appreciate me saying this or perhaps agree with it, but everyone is counting numbers right now within a unit, within battalions, within brigades. It's like everyone's quietly networking, Sunni commander to Sunni commander, Shia commander to Shia commander. So if it falls apart, who's going to take how many tanks? Who's going to take how many forces? Who's going to have so many weapons? I mean,
they're parsing this now?
Yeah, totally. I mean, everyone's got to be ready for the worst-case scenario.
Right.
And the worst-case scenario is that the government simply falls apart.
Absolutely. And the very, very worst is clearly an open civil war. But as some people will tell me, including Iraqi intelligence and some other observers, there's already a very quiet civil war underway. There is tit-for-tat assassinations. There are death squads roaming the country, killing either sides.
I guess it's all how you look at it. It seems like there's been a civil war on some level going on since the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, so, in very many ways. And both sides of this civil war or this division are very heavily armed, and definitely mean business.
Now, the other question I wanted to ask you is that Chalabi, who has obviously been on the payroll of the U.S. for a long time and in relationship with the U.S. in a long time, is there any chance, just in your mind, because I was thinking about this the other day, when they searched his house and they accused him of being a spy for Iran, was that just some sort of strange reprimand, just keep him in line? Because clearly he's still the American
guy. He's still
guy.
A player. He's still a player. Look, he's a Teflon man. Nothing sticks to Ahmed Chalabi. You've got to give it to him. He is the consummate politician. He's been able to reinvent himself how many times? And I think it's for the Americans with Chalabi now, there's no real kinship. It's any port in a storm. They're looking for anyone within this new power bloc with whom they can deal on some level. There is no love lost between the U.S. military and Ahmed Chalabi.
Mm-hmm.
Have no fear. That raid on his house was very, very real. And I remember when I first met Ahmed Chalabi, it was in Sulaymaniyah in Kurdistan in the months leading up before the war. And there was his triumphant arrival as, you know, the president in waiting as he was painting himself.
The savior.
Well, he'd just come from Tehran, from where he'd been given an office building and where he'd been given much support. And
well, he gets it wherever he can get it, doesn't he?
Totally. The dude, you got to give it to him, man. Like, he can screw everyone and have them all smiling. You know?
Is he getting anything for the Kurds yet?
Yeah.
Is he working on that?
Well, I know that when he left the hotel where we were staying, the Sulaymaniyah Palace, he took out the entire fifth floor for his entourage. He's like, you know, a Iraqi political rock star.
It's like
now,
Tom DeLay.
Yeah, now, yeah, right. As I understand it from the PUK, the governing Kurdish party up there, he skipped the bill.
Charles
Talabani had to pay for it. Now,
he should just have the Kurds pay for it.
Yeah, have the Kurds pay for it.
The Kurdish lobby could pay for
it. So,
you want a militia? Pay.
Yeah, so, you know, Chalabi is a fascinating character, and he plays all sides against each other.
So let's get back to, why don't we cover a little bit before you go. When you were here last time, a friend of yours had gotten kidnapped, and you were involved in negotiations to get him out. How did that resolve itself?
Well, what happened was, this was one of my Iraqi reporters, and he was taken by Zarqawi's people for a number of reasons, and he was held in and around Fallujah. Now, during the offensive in November, the Marines overran the safe house where he was. They found him beaten and near to death, but they figured he was a bad guy, so they put him in the hospital, and then they threw him in Bulka prison in southern Iraq. Now, a prisoner who was released made his way back to Baghdad and got me a message to say that my man was down there. So I was able to contact the authorities, establish his identity, and they flew him up to Baghdad and released him at Checkpoint 1 at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
So he's still out there, and he's still a very good friend of mine, and bravely he continues to work.
Wow.
Since then, however, I've had another one of my Iraqi reporters kidnapped, again by Zarqawi's people. This followed the arrest of a senior Zarqawi commander in Baghdad by the Americans. So they went into house cleaning, internal investigation. He was seen as a weak link for his connection to a journalist. So they took him on February 6th. For 5 days, they tortured him endlessly. But he maintained his line. He said, you know, Michael Ware is just a journalist. I'm helping him, this, that, and the other. Not CIA, not this, not that. After the 5 days of interrogation or torture, the Zarqawi guys did their own investigation and went and spoke to, you know, corroborative sources, commanders that I'd spoken to, who then vouched for him and for me to say, look, you know, this guy is a journalist. He's always played a straight bat. So this fellow was eventually released to me. But suffice to say, he was in a terrible, terrible condition.
What would happen to a reporter who was captured like that and didn't have you to have his back?
Well, I mean, I'm not the wonder cure, but we are definitely fair game. I mean, let's put it this way. I was with some bad guys just before I left, and we were watching that video that came out of the helicopter that was shot down with the 11 security contractors and so forth on board. And there's that terrible scene, parts of which have been aired here, where the pilot is found in the rushes alive, and then he stood up, and then he's executed there on the spot, and it's on film for all to see. I turned to one of my contacts, and I said to him, now, if that guy was laying there and had been saying, Ana Sahafi, meaning I'm a journalist, would it have made any difference? He went, no.
Well, you know what? Be careful, Mick, and it's great to see you again.
Great to see you as always. Thanks.
Yeah. Pleasure, guys. Pleasure.
Have a good time. Have, fun. Have a good time stateside if you can. I'm sure you need the R&R.
Oh, yeah, baby. Watch out. Look up your daughters, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, by the way, my girlfriend listening, you didn't hear me say that.
He was kidding. Ha, ha, ha. I've done that before. All right, we'll be back in a second. 48 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
Absolutely free. Even the phone call is free. Call 877-757-2668. That's 877-757-2668. Call right now.
Mark Riley, it's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Yes, it is.
53 past the hour. We're going to land this thing. Let's take a call. We got Ted in Nebraska. Ted, how are you?
I'm all right. I think it's despicable the way the liberals are trying to kidnap the Ethics Committee to conduct a witch hunt on Tom DeLay.
Oh, no. I hate when... help me, Riley. Oh, my God. It's... Oh, no. Oh, no. It's happening. My thoughts are starting to change. I'm becoming him. Oh, no.
Live from Radio Halliburton, it's Right and Early, the conservatives' way to wake up with Mark the Shark Maron.
Good morning, neocons. It's 34 past the hour here on Radio Halliburton. Vengeance with volume. So the Democrats are screwing around with the Ethics Committee. Wait a minute. Democrats, ethics, in the same sentence? What's the word for that? Thank you, Mr. Dictionary. Anyway, what do Democrats know about ethics?
Blah, 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 blah.
Are you telling me Barbara Boxer doesn't deal crack out of her office? Are you telling me John Kerry never robbed a 7-Eleven to feed his raging meth habit? Are you telling me Hillary Clinton doesn't shoplift Vienna sausage from Costco? Well, how would anybody know? Everybody's too busy crucifying Tom DeLay over a few business trips. Big deal. Oh, he's from Texas, and he plays golf in Scotland. He must be the devil. I hear he got an AOL disc in the mail for nothing. Oh, bad man. Put him in jail forever. Thanks for the ethics lesson, pothead. That's hilarious coming from the party of Bill Clinton. If there's one thing Bubba knows all about, it's violation. Yeah. Whoa, whoa. Bubba's loose in the barnyard. Somebody call animal control.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
Hey, it's 51 past the hour. Let's take a call. You're on the air, caller.
Tommy Pinko, liberals, New York.
That's right. Right you are. That's it. You've been sharked, buddy. What's going on? What's going on? Right you are. So it's been a year since the shocking, disturbing images came out of Abu Ghraib, and right now I'd like to take a moment to reflect on those terrible events. There you go. Then you've been sharked, buddy. It's 52 after the hour, time for the neocon traffic. Oh, on the road to justice. Expect delays. Tom DeLay. Remember, patriots, Tom DeLay's legal fund needs your money. Stick around, neocons. We'll be back with Toby Keith.
Hit that dial, patriots. We'll be back with Right and Early.
Whoa. Man, what just happened, dude? Where's Mick?
Man, you got to get help for that.
I thought I was just... The show's over already?
Mick's halfway to New Mexico.
Oh, man. Wait.
You blacked out for a minute, man.
Did I say goodbye and everything?
No. You have not done.
Well, maybe I can get him out in the hall there. So what's going on this weekend? I'm going to be doing some comedy at the Improv here in New York.
Oh, you're going to the Improv?
Yeah, my wife's in town. It's going to be good. What do you got going?
I have no idea. I'm born on the path led by my wife and daughter.
Well, we got a pretty big week next week. Martin. Oh, what? Hey, come.
Whoa.
There you go. It's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here you go. Here for the week. we can celebrate Arbor Day by replaying President Bush's wooden performance at last night's press conference. Two, stand up in the middle of a Tribeca Film Festival screening to remind everyone that this is the first anniversary of the Abu Ghraib scandal. Three, praise CBS for canceling the boring jingoistic military drama JAG. Now it's time to cancel that boring jingoistic military drama in Iraq. Four, just because the Republicans back down on the Ethics Committee rules, don't get comfortable. Having to be ethical just makes them mean. Today's phrase, hey, Bush, nice going, man. You actually had a press conference without getting Jeff Gannon's chapstick all over your ass.